Welcome to the Autistic License Podcast. I'm Leo in London.
I'm Shauna, and I'm in Carrickfergus in Northern Ireland.
We invite you to listen in on our conversations as we experiment with unmasking in an autistic space. We talk about what it means to discover we're autistic as adults, especially with established careers as therapists. We want people to know that autistic therapists exist and to broaden the conversation about neurodiversity. You're so welcome to join us, whoever you are and wherever in the world you are. We hope you'll find something of interest and connection here.
Had a conversation yesterday that kind of made us think that we might get a recording in this week rather than skip.
Yes.
Whenever you were challenging me in relation to what happened on our last podcast.
Okay.
Do you remember
this? I remember. Yeah, yes, I do. So I was challenging you on some confidence, I think, is how I framed it, in your subjective truth. There's a conceptual introduction.
Okay.
You are very sure you have a formula in your head, which you've repeated.
Uh-huh.
That you will meet, if you meet 10 people, and two of them will like you and think you're great.
Uh-huh.
And is it another two that will really despise you and dislike you intensely?
Normally it's double that. I think normally, actually it's four.
Four, okay. And then you've got four left who will be a bit meh about you. But you're quite convinced that your perception of those numbers and of those people's actual feelings are definitely, definitely true in a way that I tried to challenge you on.
Uh-huh.
And you weren't having any of it. I know. I just know.
This is true in a
way that, as I suggested to you then, if a client of yours was speaking with such absolute certainty about a subjective truth, you'd want to challenge them.
Yes, that is right. And I think the very fact that we, you know, obviously we recorded that conversation, we listened to it again to edit it. I allowed it to go out. We allowed it to go out.
Mm.
And then it kind of almost puts it on the radar again for coming back to, you know, because you can have those kind of conversations and then they can be over. But there's an accountability in doing a podcast even to yourself, because then you have to hear yourself say something again. And then you have to be open then to return to it, which I think is why I kind of said to you yesterday, let's record tomorrow. Because otherwise we'll not capture this. And this is important for me in general, but it might also be like a follow-up that other people might be interested in.
Because, sorry to just interrupt, because I know I'll forget, because they may have had thoughts about how you presented that at the time, but more importantly, they may recognise some of that way of thinking and talking in people close to them.
Yeah. And I also want to point out that it might be a common neurodivergent experience.
That's what I mean. Yes,
that's, yeah. You know, yeah. But even just to experience oneself like that in the world as part of autistophobia. So I think, you know, I'm up for, I think there's a few things here. I'm up for the challenge and I'm up for exploring that. And I also want to say another thing that dawned on me is that there may be an autistic experience in the world whereby actually we are disliked by most people. And so although my dogmatism about it is what we're going to debate, there may actually be some truth in that in general, autistic people are not liked as much as non-autistic people. So, you know, within the neurotypical community. This is where I've changed, where I'm kind of like, well, if there was 30 autistic people, potentially lots of them would like me. But because we are normally in an environment where it's neurotypical people, that's where the discrepancy is.
Okay. And why did I feel such a strong need to challenge your certainty there? partly because that is what I do, and it's what I do in my work. My interventions are largely challenging prejudice or prejudgment, so, you know, assumptions that may need
beliefs from childhood. Yeah,
exactly. There's like that.
Yeah.
But also there's how we each react to that idea of being liked or not, which is quite polar. Mm-hmm. As you pointed out, mm-hmm. I'm a nice guy is what you said. I don't mm-hmm. I don't want to go into that particular phraseology because it's uncomfortable.
I know you don't like
but
it.
It's so important, clearly, for me to have, you know, my please others driver does dominate. I am intensely uncomfortable if I get the feeling that somebody doesn't like me. And so for you to, as I saw it at the time, blindly accept that most people don't like you, mm-hmm. and therefore by extension me, because mm-hmm. I feel so similar to you in so many ways.
I didn't get that.
Okay. Neither did I until this conversation. I've suddenly realised why I felt so defensive and so needy that you change your mind or that you open your mind a little bit to the possibility that you might be wrong. Because, it, of course, yeah, by extension, we're uh-huh. talking about me too.
Uh-huh.
I'm somebody that most people probably don't like then.
If my theory.
And it is a theory, and we both accept that, but
so we both actually have gone back over this in our minds and applied that. I wonder if you would like to define, you know, the please people driver, because that is TA language.
And what I like about TA language is that it's, and it's one of the reasons I chose it to train in as my core modality, is because it's plain English. So it is exactly what it says. There is a subconscious, very, very deep rooted and probably lifelong drive mm-hmm. to please others. Now, that sounds like a positive, but it depends to what extent you do that. And what somebody with a very strong please others driver will do is act on that drive at their own expense very often. So yeah. that from the outside, you could look at that as a transaction and say, well, that's not balanced. That's not worth it. The amount of energy or discomfort that you're going to experience from trying to make somebody else feel okay is massively disproportionate to how not okay it ends up making you feel.
Great, yeah.
Is that?
Yeah, I think that's great. I think that maybe something around, so TA is a counselling modality that Leo did specialist training in. It stands for transactional analysis.
A psychotherapeutic training.
A psychotherapeutic training that Leo did at a prestigious institution in London. What I just wonder, and this might be going off on a tangent, sometimes I just get very aware that we take things for granted in the language that we use. And even talking about a driver, mm-hmm. you know, I guess that's just a drive by which, and we all have these, what can be called, another word is injunction, like a belief, a core belief. Mm-hmm. And so please others could be one. Can you give some other examples of
be
some
strong,
others?
Be strong, yeah. Hurry up, try hard.
Yeah.
And injunctions, it's very unfair. There are 5 drivers, but there are 11 injunctions.
Okay.
And all the drivers have an exclamation mark at the end of them. And all the injunctions start with the word don't.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Don't be, don't belong.
Don't exist.
Don't exist being the absolute extreme one.
Yeah, but that's mine. I did so much therapy on that years and years ago.
That's an interesting one because you and I think, probably share versions of that. The example that's often given in training, you know, if somebody's mother dies in childbirth,
yep.
then you carry all your life the fact that your very existence mm-hmm. snuffed out the existence yeah. of your mother. So yeah. that will be
yeah, yeah,
a don't
yeah.
exist. But again, you can dial that down to, you know, my version of that is that I was unplanned.
Yeah.
And I may carry, although it may not have ever been explicitly expressed to me, I may carry a message, true or not, that I messed up some people's lives by turning up when yes. I did.
Yes, yes, yes. And it can also refer, though, to, which for me is more like don't actualize. You know,
so don't reach your potential.
Don't reach your potential, or don't be seen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, simply, like, don't exist in a full, vibrant, alive self way.
Yes.
You know, and that, so that ties into a lot of my history of dampen down, don't be seen. Mm. Invisibility cloak.
Don't make it or don't succeed as an injunction, which would also
don't make
be about
it is my is
not
probably mine as well.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. But the don't exist is that feeds into the always be under the radar. Like, at school it would be like, so I, you know, I did consultations with my daughter's teachers the other day, yeah. And one of them, there was a big confusion mix up, and like, kind of didn't know who she was and shouldn't have, actually, because it's not her main teacher. So in that case, it was okay. But for me, that would have been a common experience. Teachers would not know who I was. Like, it was as if I didn't exist. So like, at school, I used to wander in and out of the school grounds, and I wasn't allowed to. That was not allowed. I was a so-called good pupil, but because I didn't actually register, I would get away with wandering out, coming back. I held down a job over a lunchtime in sixth form in a cafe outside of school. Now, that was a social context for me.
Yes.
But I wandered out of school and did that job because I was enrolled in classes
Incredible.
I didn't go to.
Incredible.
You know, and I was also supposedly a prefect who was supposed to stop other people from leaving the school grounds. Sorry, 1993, 1994, come and get me. You know, but like, that was how invisible I was, that I would enroll in, like, I was enrolled in these obscure subjects like photography and Japanese, and I never showed up, and I just got away with it. And these were like filler subjects. I would show up when I had to my core A-level subjects, but I enrolled in these other things. And so I was supposed to be somewhere, but no one knew who I was. But even like my core subjects, like even when I was like doing, so my daughter's at GCSE stage, when I was at that stage, the consultations would say, yeah, she'll probably get to C, you know, like they were all predicting me like 2 grades less than what I would get, because they didn't know who I was. I didn't participate. They didn't know I was smart, you know, but I didn't affect them in any shape or form, because when it counted, the homework was in, but actually they didn't really know who I was. So it was conscientious, you know, they all wrote the same thing on the report card. They all said the same thing, but they didn't actually realise my potential. Like, I could have been one of their pupils that, you know, and it was a very, very, it was a prestigious grammar school, and there was a lot of very good students in it. So I'm not saying I was right at the very top, but I got a string of A's, you know, and I got 3 A's at A level. You know, I was way above what they thought, but they were projecting way beneath all of those, because they just didn't know I existed. And it suited me, that, because I also didn't want to be moulded into, this is one of, oh, she's good at English, she should be in the debating society, or she's good at this, or she's good at
that. That's it as well, isn't it? Yes. So
it's a demand avoidance.
It's demand avoidance, but it is also about the not achieving and not actualising. You know, there's don't be important is one that's about being quite visible.
Yes.
And it isn't necessarily just because you don't want to be seen, because people will think badly of you. As you were just saying then, you don't want to be seen achieving either, because of the pressure that will put you in. If you're smart, you'll be put on the debating, you know.
Or encouraged to go to Oxford and Cambridge.
Exactly.
Or those things.
And then you're faced, well, I would be, imagining myself in that position, faced with doing something that I may well be bright enough for or capable enough for, but I don't feel that way. And that's a terrifying thought. That I mean, I suppose I've had this in the careers I've had prior to being a therapist.
Okay.
Always imposter syndrome, always feeling out of my depth, always feeling that everybody else was naturally doing what they do, and I just did not know what I'm supposed to be doing.
But people saw your potential, and you were, you know, hey, do this.
Exactly. And the other part of me that liked the affirmation and wanted to please others would bite their hands off. Oh, yes, that sounds like that's going to make me feel good about myself, because I will be more senior. I'll manage this many people, or I will work for this well-known organization.
Yeah.
But the internal struggle was was the polar opposite of that. I can't do this. I don't know what I'm doing. People think I'm an idiot.
Okay. You see, I almost had the opposite, whereby I knew what I was capable of. Now, that's not, there's been times in my life when, and in my teens, when I was really down on myself and depressed and thought I was rubbish. But at other times, people would have seen, actually they wouldn't have, but inside of me, I'd have known that I was quietly confident. Like I kind of knew what I was capable of, even though the teachers didn't. So then I was able to just kind of go, well, I'll just quietly get on with this, rate schedules, 8 weeks of revision, everything in its place. There's this amount to cover. Here's where you'll do this. And, walked into the exams, did them. I was not an anxious taker of exams or anything like that. I did my work and I delivered what I needed to deliver. Mm. And, I knew what I could do and knew that the teachers didn't know me, but also didn't have a huge ambition to get certain scores because it was not my agenda to go to high academic institutions. And so I didn't do that. Mm. So that's why I didn't need them to discover me and push me to go to Oxford or Cambridge because I didn't want to go to those places. Mm. If I had wanted to, then I might have made it happen for myself. But I kind of was able to quietly execute whatever I needed to quietly execute and have always been, but also needed to keep that on the down low for demand avoidance reasons, and because it was never about competition or other people. It just never was and never is. So it just has, it's never been about if I can get this, then I can do that, then I can be seen, then I can achieve this, or then I can get paid. Like, I'm so compared.
Hello, it's Leo here with my editor hat on. At this point in the recording, one of our recorders failed for about 10 minutes, but we didn't want to lose this bit of the conversation, so we're including it here, although the audio quality will be slightly different for that time.
What my potential has been at different times to earn and how little I have actually earned. That, and I still haven't paid off student loans because the powers that be believe that I still, at 48, don't earn anywhere near what they would need me to be earning to pay off student loans. So they see me as someone who has not reached in her potential at all, what I studied for. So there's such big, big discrepancies between how I've used things like intelligence and what that actually looks like in the markers of success or finances or anything like that.
I called up on my phone the list of drivers and injunctions because I've never memorized them all. Yeah. Like I couldn't remember the Be Perfect one when I was listing out the drivers before.
Do you have that one?
I have had in particular areas, but this is the thing. So again, like every psychological model, we are missing the it depends tick box. I always say that because there are certain circumstances where a particular driver injunction is very strong and others where it doesn't exist. But what I'm really struck by reading them to myself right now in the context of our conversation is how many of the injunctions apply, like all of them in various ways. And you could argue all of the drivers too, but they seem to be more specific. I don't know what that is about. They seem to be more context specific. Just to go through those because they're there. All exclamation marks at the end. Please others, be perfect, be strong, try hard, hurry up. And there are certain bits of my life where all of those apply in different amounts, I guess. But the injunctions are astonishingly autistic now I look at them through this lens. So we started with the don't exist. There is probably a fairly universal experience of not fitting in, which can feed that. Don't be you. That's masking. That's just a description of masking. Do not be you.
Maybe I have that one.
I think, well, as I go through as I go through them, I think you're going to relate like I am in a very autistic way. Don't be a child. Now, there are certain ways in which we have to rationalize things in a very adult way at a very, very early, but at a very early age.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then you've got the opposite one to that. Don't grow up.
Okay.
And look at how we eat. Look at how all the childish, air quotes, things that we do and ways that we make sense of things that never fully reaches adulthood, that or we feel like not a proper grown up because of the comparisons to neurotypical. Then we have don't make it or don't succeed, which you've already very covered. And then we have don't do anything. Just do not cause a ripple at all. Keep still. Do not become visible or do not have an effect on anything else.
Or could that also be like autistic inertia, where people just don't do anything?
That's more of a can't, though, isn't it, I suppose? But it could be well driven by, if I do anything, it's going to affect things and people, yeah. And I mustn't.
Yeah, but also where I'll fuck it up. That's
yes.
What people sometimes think.
Yes.
If I do anything,
yes.
It's better to do nothing.
Don't be important.
Mm-hmm.
That's similar to the don't make it one,
yeah.
or is in our experience,
yeah, yeah.
Of why that don't belong. Now that's a really weird one, because so much of the time we spend most of our lives out of awareness trying to belong.
Yeah.
That now don't belong has now become a core value for me in a way, because I know now that I'm not supposed to fit in ways that I've always believed.
Yeah.
So maybe that's not so much of an injunction as it's become a driver, almost of a permission.
Yeah.
And then we've got don't be well, and that's sometimes phrased as don't be sane.
Okay, so it's mental health as well.
Absolutely, maybe even more often than not. Mm-hmm. But and that we definitely carry.
As autistic,
because often being unwell in some way is how we can get our needs met sometimes. It's only by really falling over that then responsibilities might be temporarily lifted from us, or people might come to our aid,
okay.
You know, emotionally or otherwise.
Yeah.
Don't think.
Uh-huh.
Don't know about that one.
A lot of us overthink.
Yeah.
Well, no, we're told.
But then we're told we're overthinking, so actually there may well be an injunction of don't think. And finally, don't feel. And that's massive. Stop overreacting. Why are you becoming so emotional? It's not that bad. Stop making a fuss. So we are riddled, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
At least out of awareness we are. And that's kind of the point of all of these models and exercises, is that we bring them out. That's my work, you know, make the invisible visible. You bring it out, name it, and say, is that really true?
Yes. Well, I would say there's parts of you that believe that.
Yes, lovely.
Parts believe it.
This is what I was saying to you recently about that lovely combination of language between TA and IFS, which is your one of your co-modalities, internal family systems, and you talk about parts.
Yeah.
And so parts can have certain drivers, parts can have... It's another way of describing those different aspects, but I really love using that in the broadest sense, those bits of language to describe, because then you can separate yourself from some of those, the least helpful of the drivers or of the injunctions or of the ego states or of the positions on the drama triangle. There's going to be a great big list of links in there in the show notes for this one, because I'm touching on so many, you know, models. But they're also useful because they name things and they separate them from your, what you would say, you know, core self.
That's right.
And true self.
This was really just a kind of a, what you would call a sidebar, but it's really interesting that I have picked up some of your language and not just one. So a sidebar was, do you want to define PA? The drivers, and we went right into that. I'm going to go back to, I guess, that your challenge then to use my own language might be a part of you, Shauna, really believes this narrative.
Hmm.
Where did that, you know, can you separate from that part and
yes,
see
exactly
that other parts might feel other things, or that there might be an external reality that is is other things. And maybe in that moment that part couldn't do that. And as I've kind of already hinted at, maybe also that part carries something that needs to be extrapolated on or explored more in terms of being an autistic person in a neurotypical society. Potentially that does mean that we are going to be liked less. And that's, you know, maybe not in statistics that I said and maybe not personal to me, but if we're referring to an autistic person in a room of neurotypical people, maybe that part has some points. That's what we've been saying, or that's what we've been wondering about. And that's often the case with IFS and with working with parts. We're not getting rid, we're not telling them that they're wrong. We're, you know, we are unpacking where they got the thing from. We're trying to help them not to work so hard. And we're also validating the things that they know and that they can teach and share with us, and the wisdom for our own lives and sometimes in a more general way. And I guess it also links into that idea that we have been trained, and everyone really has been trained as in whatever therapeutic model in our field, by predominantly neurotypical theorists.
Oh, totally, yes.
So TA was developed for neurotypical people by neurotypical people to have neurotypical people train in it.
Yes.
So a lot of that stuff might need adapted.
Retooling is that's what I've been saying now for the last year, but and I've said this on the show before.
Memory foam.
Oh, bollocks.
What does that mean?
It means your memory's full and I guess it's not recording anymore. So let's pause. That's part one.
So we're back. We just had an alarm there because my memory was full.
Let's be clear. The recorder's memory was full.
Maybe my memory was full. Maybe my memory was full as well. Glitch of the recording device in my head.
So what I think I was talking about was, for the first year in practice post-diagnosis, so 2 years ago, I really just wanted to jettison all of the models and theories because I could see, well, these don't work. You know, what's your life position? Well, there's an it depends box missing from that.
Yes.
You know, what's your predominant, what are the predominant drivers and injunctions that affect you? Well, it depends. Yeah. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
What I've been doing, I think, as you just mentioned, is realizing, no, TA is actually a brilliant model for autism, but it needs to be retooled.
Yeah.
So that these things aren't absolutes. We look at through the language of TA, which is really useful because it's plain English.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, there's no mystery about it. It's very practical. Mm-hmm. So those are very autism friendly concepts. But we need the variance. We need to say when, and that's where the IFS language helps out, because we can talk about then parts. Rather than I have a very strong please others driver, we can say parts of me do and start to think about identifying them and which parts do not, because they're probably the helpful ones that can model things for us about how we can be. So when you talked at the beginning here, when we talked about that challenge to your very fixed thinking there, you said, well, maybe there's part of me that really, really believes that. But there are other parts who might be a little bit more open-minded or might have a different view. And so...
Well, I didn't say that, actually. But I think...
You assigned some of that to parts, I think.
Well, I think that that's language of what you're challenging is, could this part soften a little bit to allow other parts as well to have what they might think? And I think whenever parts get really extreme and really, again, like rigid is something that we as autistic people would be accused of, isn't it? But in IFS, in a non-pathologizing way, might kind of say, well, you know, why does it need to be extreme, and what within it is actually helpful, like I was saying, and what does it also need released from? And then whenever it softens back a bit, there may be other parts that have other beliefs, or it might be that the core self just holds some of that, or holds the possibility for some of that. But I also want to say that it's not a case of IFS being autistic and neurodiversity friendly at all. We have a lot of issues within IFS where, and in fact, there's a group of us that are working hard and have managed to be in connection with the diversity and inclusion or equality, I can't remember what they call themselves, the committee within the IFS Institute, to kind of try and dialogue about some of this stuff, because much of the approach to autism has been autism as parts, and is still very pathologizing towards autistic people. They're very good on, you know, race and culture and affinity groups in relation to that, but in relation to neurodiversity they definitely lag behind, and have made some efforts but stop short of really being affirming or hearing a range of autistic voices, you know, as opposed to just one or two. But also as a training and as a model in it as it is now, it is not autistic and neurodivergent client friendly or therapist friendly. You know, so it also has to be retooled quite a bit to make it helpful and affirming to neurodivergent people. And there's not a lot of kind of training or guidance or awareness around about that, certainly among the senior staff. That might be changing, but changing very, very, very slowly. So let's just get away from the IFS is the panacea, because there's enough of that out there in the world without perpetuating that myth.
Any psychological model.
Or any model. It's wonderful, but it's not the answer to all people at all times in all places.
And we come back again to the core truth of relational work, which is the biggest determiner of outcome is the client-therapist relationship.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with the modality or how closely you follow your own modality.
Yeah.
We're repeating this because it's
true
over and over. And again, the catchphrase, which I think we will probably end up using in every single episode, this is why we need autistic therapists.
Yeah, and this is why we need humanity and human people connection. You know, that there's something about, you know, well, Carl Jung, the master, you know, said, like, know all your theories, master all the tools, but whenever you go into a room with another person, be just another human soul. You know,
exactly.
Like, actually, that's what we do, and that's what people need. You know, all of this knowledge and approaches and everything goes by the by whenever we're in a room with another person. They need someone human who is present and connected and regulated to be with them for that length of time.
It seems odd, doesn't it, that we talk about relational psychotherapy as a thing, as if there's any other kind. Which there is. We know there is. That we know that there are plenty of therapists who don't work relationally as a choice because they need to keep themselves in their modality very separate from the person that they're sat with. But it's kind of, it makes me feel like we talked the other week about people who have non-judgmental and in their descriptions of their practice.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, they wouldn't put non-racist because of course not. But of course not non-judgmental too. And of course, relational.
Phoebe is regulating me at present.
Oh, I can hear it from here, hopefully.
Oh, I don't know if it'll be picked up in the recording, but she's purring away on my knee. This is why it's nice to podcast indoors or in the house.
Would you unclip your mic and just hold it by her for a minute?
Do you think that you'll be able to pick it up?
Yeah,
they'll be able to pick it up?
I think so.
Phoebe, talk to the listeners. What's that? What's that? Thank you, Carol. Huh? Thank you.
I'll loop that as a bed under the theme at the end.
Yeah. Thank you, Phoebe. Do I need to go back to the challenge-y kind of bech that I wanted to unpack a bit more? Because actually what you said to me was, you know, Shauna, you want feedback and you want people to be open with you. However, because you're so confident in the things that you say, that may actually stop people from giving you the feedback that you want. And then of course we talked about the actual context of that podcast, and that's what we've been talking about today, and you know that there's so many more nuances in it, but as a general challenge it was about that way of being, which is not how I am all the time, I don't think.
No, I know that,
but
yeah,
that was the challenge, and that's what really got me thinking, because I guess that I really trustfully do want feedback and want people to be as honest as they can possibly be with me. And like, I really do. Like, I'm not really scared of them saying bad things. I just want them to say it. But you were saying that there might be something in my confidence that could get in the way of that. So that was the thing that on a selfish basis, I was interested in unpacking.
Selfish in as much as you're not getting what you want on or are asking for, which in this specific case is feedback from people listening to us or challenges.
Oh, no, not in relation to saying to any listeners or anything like that I'm not getting what I want. Although, you know, I will always take more. I love that people get in touch with us and we always answer. If we've missed you, we're so sorry. We try and answer everything. And I totally love that. I'm always going to ask for more of that because I love that. And no, that's not my complaint and that's not my selfishness that I'm saying. I mean selfish in that before we finish this conversation today, whether or not it goes out in a podcast, my selfish agenda is to explore more with you so that I might become someone who knows herself even more better and then does not put obstacles in the way of people giving me feedback due to my confidence in how I put things across.
And I think that exploration, and we're already doing it and have largely done it, in fact, hopefully actually will have this similar effect on me at my polar opposite position, that people may resist criticizing me because they may perceive me to be so fingers in their ears, humming at anything negative, being so please others, being so nice guy, in whatever terms that might
really
mean.
That really hit you, didn't it? And it wasn't supposed to be a put down at all. It was not meant to be.
It was just that it was an extreme. It was just an extreme. That's all. And I'm so, because of that core value of balance and fairness, that any hint that I might be extreme in some way, is disturbing. It's not what I want. Yeah. And maybe there are similar barriers to people, you know, giving me feedback or critical feedback or positive feedback actually, because of the visibility of how fixed in my thinking I might be, in a positive spin way about myself. Although I don't, no, not about myself. Anyway, I think we probably both put
maybe up, about yourself,
maybe,
but you don't want to go there right now.
That's maybe it as well. Oh God,
because you didn't like it whenever I was going. Maybe 80% might like it. No, maybe 70. You couldn't go there.
Yeah. It's got to be 110. Yes, perhaps we both have quite fixed thinking in how other people perceive us in ways that might be barriers to being challenged on it. We can challenge each other on it because this is all in awareness and we have these conversations out loud. But in the real world or in the pod world, maybe there are barriers that we haven't been aware of so far. That people don't want to challenge our fixed thinking because what would be the point? Or we'd react badly, or they might feel invalidated when we're not open to it.
Oh my, okay. Well, I hope not.
I hope not, but I'm just exploring.
And is that why autistic people get accused of being rigid and black and white thinking?
And rude, because we will state our truths very confidently.
Broken record.
My mum would often say to me that, as a child and as an adult, I think, that I would say things with such confidence that she would just believe them and never think that I might be mistaken. And then when it turns out that I'd got something wrong, it was pretty humiliating because I'd said it with such confidence that people would go, ha, see, you're not always right, that kind of thing. But also, that it wasn't that she might not have felt confident enough to challenge me, but it just believed me. Because I was so cocksure.
I know that Ricky's going to be listening to this going, see, validation 20 fucking years later.
Oh dear. Yeah.
He would have said that about me as well.
So let's I've never reframed that bit before. Is that autistic? Is that neurodivergent?
Or are we just pain in the backside?
Well, that may be the experience of being around us at those moments. Yes. But is it a product of needing to be sure? Again, because things do not make sense to us, we are in constant translation mode. We need to spot the patterns and make sense of them so that when we feel we've done that, rightly or wrongly, we need to be sure to feel safe.
Maybe.
Doubt equals danger, maybe.
Maybe. And maybe as well, it's in relation to what we may or may not be getting from the people around us. So if the people around us are being in some ways wishy-washy or non-committal or indecisive, and this is not, I know we've just referred to your mum and I've just referred to Ricky, this is not saying about those specific people.
No, I'm
talking in a more general way. If we experience the world as somewhere where people will not take a stand and will not tell us what they actually think and will not make decisions and will not come up with anything that helps give us structure and concreteness, they're not providing that for us, then we have to provide that for ourselves.
And that's it.
Perhaps that's autistic it. People experience that. Like, that's what you're it. Giving me as a template for living does not fit. Just doesn't fit because it's neurotypical. You know, you tell me that I should feel this in this scenario, this is how I will feel good. It doesn't make me feel good.
I love that phrase, a template for living.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay. Can't even remember what I said or why I said it. You've just stopped my confident flow. And I don't know why we've got to say.
That'll teach you.
Fuck it. You met your match.
The template doesn't fit. And so we need to make another one that we need to have absolute confidence in and therefore speak very back to the stridently again.
Stridently. And it's like, well, this works for me and nothing that you're offering me as an alternative works. It's not like I haven't listened to you, but you're not giving me anything. So I'll put something out there.
Yeah.
And maybe we just have less of a tolerance for the not knowing. Or it's not less of a tolerance for not knowing, because we do actually, the spirituality of autistic people is fascinating. And we do actually have capacity for so much of that and so much access to the unconscious. So it's not that we don't have a capacity for not knowing, but there's certain things that we don't get our needs met in because we're living in a world that's not designed for us.
Sure.
And so we have to be certain on aspects that maybe people who are not autistic don't need to be dogmatic about, because they're getting their needs met in general, so they can have uncertainty about other basics, such as who exactly likes me, to go back to that. So I, because my schedule is so tight today, I need to allow myself transition and eating time now before I go into the next thing, or I really will have no spoons left by the end of the day. So I hope that we, despite our drama in the middle whenever my recorder stopped, I hope we're going to have enough there. It's normally you that's trying to wind me up, but today I realised that I wind me up as in, like, get me to stop. Yes. Not wind
not,
me
not
up.
Not wind you up as in irritate you to the point of explosion.
Yeah, I meant it like that. It's normally you that's trying to do that to me, but I feel like today it's role reversal because you've got a bit of a lighter schedule in the next wee while than
indeed,
what
I do. But here comes the theme tune. So that was well timed.
that's not actually real, listeners. He's just like making that up.
Don't destroy the artifice. They think there's a band in the next room that slowly moves towards us.
Well, I guess that everybody has their own images of what actually happens. It has been lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, you too. Really good. We'll do this again soon. And we'll speak to you, the listeners, very shortly.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Autistic License podcast. You can connect with us via Instagram, Facebook, at autisticlicense.com, or by email at autisticlicense@gmail.com. At this point, Leo likes me to spell the word license because we spell it in different ways in different parts of the world. We spell it L-I-C-E-N-C-E. We also have a thriving Facebook community. You can search for Autistic License Shauna and Leo on Facebook, or you can click on the link in the show notes.